after by publishers who say, well, this is an amazing story, you should write it. And he, with an assistant or a collaborator, he begins to write his autobiography. And at this point, the Israelis, and particularly Ben-Gurion, are terrified at what he might say. He's going to point out that a leading Labor Party official collaborated with the Nazis. He's going to point out that the Zionist agency ignored the peril of Ben-Gurion Jews. So they send their fixer, Teddy Kollek, who we think of as the mild-mannered mayor of Jerusalem, but in fact was a major political fixer for Ben-Gurion. And what Kollek does is he begs him not to write the autobiography, and Brandt just insists, of course, he will. And at that point, Kollek says, well, I'll tell you what, in that case, let us publish it for you, because we'll make sure it gets really well published. And Brandt trusts him, they publish it, and what they do is they put in a foreword that basically just, in effect, reverses his story. They completely undo him. Well, Brandt and his wife, in some sense, had the last laugh because they collected all of the letters to Teddy Kollek and published those, showing the double dealing. But, in fact, the Labor government does have control in Israel, and they do squelch it, and he remains a very small man, ignored. He goes back to the cafes, to playing cards, to gambling, and to railing against this world that had ignored him. He never forgets it and dies alone and bitter.
Hmm. Yeah, and then, of course, Kastner gets assassinated soon after the trial. I came across a documentary. I haven't watched it yet, which deals with Kastner's life. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I've actually shared a podium with the director of the documentary. It's an interesting film, and one worth seeing. It takes a very different perspective on Kastner. She tends to see Kastner as a kind of heroic figure, that he saved lives, and she brings the testimony in of people he saved. And as I said, he did save lives, and mm-hmm. it's important that he did. It just, the question we ask is at what price?
Yeah.
And it's a difficult question.
Those are the difficult questions. And what was the reception to the book so far, because it's only just been out this last year, to the book among your colleagues in the academy or among the Jewish historians? Or have there been some strong reactions?
It's been favorably reviewed. Isvan Diak, who's a wonderful historian at Columbia University, reviewed it in the New Republic and was very generous with the book. And I think both recognize the importance of the story and the sort of narrative thrust of the book, that this was a book that's accessible to a general reader about this very important period and episode. As you know, the book industry is going through a real shakeout now,
yeah.
And this is a new time for me as well, when you suddenly discover that you're selling almost as many electronic copies as hardcover copies.
Yeah.
It's a very different sort of publishing world out there. I don't ever aspire to competing with Sarah Palin in terms of selling copies, but that is the reality of the publishing world.
Oh, yeah. You've got to make a big splash. Have you published it in Israel? Has there been
No, it has not come out in Israel yet.
Oh, interesting.
It would be interesting if it did.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's going to be an interesting book for them to review. I'm really in awe of the achievement here. It was just one of the best reading experiences I've had for a long, long time, and I really felt that you placed what was so you basically don't leave the reader with much choice but to keep reading. It's a page turner of an unusual kind. Wanted to know two things. What are you researching next? That's the first question. Have you got something new to grab your?
I'm just finishing up a book. It's a very different book. It's a novel, and basically, it's a book about how two different books influence the lives of people over a long span of time. One of the books is the Aleppo Codex, which is basically the biblical text on which the Torahs that we read in the synagogue are based, and is in fact the definitive Hebrew Bible, and it's had a rather checkered history, and there are some huge blanks in the history, and for a novelist, whenever there's a blank in the history, very inviting because you're allowed to fill it in. And the second is a very little-known prayer book that I discovered. It's written in Judeo-Provençal, that is a Provençal language written in Hebrew characters. There's only one copy of it anywhere in the world. It's in a museum in Leeds, in England. And it begins with an unusual prayer. It's written by a woman, and the prayer is basically, "Dear God, blah, 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 thank you for making me a woman," which is, of course, a reversal of the traditional morning prayer said by Jewish men. And so I decided to explore those books and how they would change the lives of people as a novel. Just finishing that one.
It's great the way you move back and forth between the two. Do you enjoy one rather than the other, or are they both got different challenges?
Very different challenges. With the narrative history, you're bound by the rules, you're bound by the evidence you have, and the trick is to keep the narrative drive going. You do want the reader to keep turning the pages, and so you've got to somehow sort through all that mass of evidence and come up with a story and a way of presenting the story that is engaging to a general reader. The novel, you would think it's much simpler because you can invent whatever you want, but the novel has a different challenge, and that is that you create a character, and then you have to live with the character you created. You can't suddenly make your character do what he or she doesn't want to do. And I've always found it fascinating to catch myself arguing with my characters and always losing the argument.
Well, Ron, I think I want to thank you very much for all your time in this podcast and your willingness to really help me understand some of these nitty, gritty parts of the narrative where what I also wanted to ask you was your other books have enormously interesting. Now I found you. I found, you know, I didn't know about you before picking up Emissary of the Doom, but now I have. Can you just say, out of the ones that you've written recently, Lawrence and Aronson and Blood Libel, whether they played some part in how you would compare the writing of those to the writing of Emissary of the Doomed?
Well, I think I have a fairly consistent style. Each of those books had a different narrative challenge to it. Lawrence and Aronson is a dual biography, and it was something I'd always wanted to do. Once I got into it, I realized how very difficult it is to do, because in a biography, you have the threads of one life, but to interweave the threads of two lives, and both to find those intersections that are essential to make it one book out of two lives, but at the same time to keep the narrative drive of both lives going was a very interesting challenge, and I hope readers find it successful. Blood Libel was a different case because it's a story that starts in Damascus, and it's a very tiny story in Damascus, and then suddenly it becomes a worldwide story. And so the question became viewpoint. Where do you see this story? And what I finally chose to do was to see the first half of the story from Damascus as if you were there and feeling the smallness and the world closing in and the hopelessness of the situation, and then to step outside of Damascus and to come to America, to Britain, to France, and to look at this faraway situation and how differently the world sees what had been so overwhelming in Damascus. And so again, it was a kind of narrative challenge forced by the sources and forced by the complexity of the story.
Do you think narrative history is on the upswing generally, and that we should be doing more narrative history in schools and colleges, that it's gotten an unfair rap from some of the professional historians, but it really is very useful and powerful ways, I think, of understanding the past?
Well, I think it is. I'm a storyteller. I'm a narrative historian, and so I'm deeply prejudiced. I love a podium to push narrative history. I think we are, to some extent, because of both short attention spans and various media that feature the moment or the, you know, a tweet of 140 characters or Facebook or all sorts of media which are against storytelling and against sustained narratives. And I think we lose something when we don't teach those in our schools and when people don't have an opportunity to use the narrative format and a fairly extended narrative to get deeply into a subject. Mm. A whole history of the Second World War is almost impossible to read unless you're using it as a textbook. Mm-hmm. But a thread that you can pick that goes through aspects of that history takes you through very difficult terrain and takes you through some very complicated history. And by using a narrative thread, you can get through that and understand a great deal more than the simple story would appear to promise.
Yeah, it just reminds me of, you know, Disraeli saying, you know, so I want to, any final words on you think the modern sort of almost takeaway for today of Joel Brand's story? Anything you would like to sort of add about what you think the story has to say to us today in this particular age and time we're living?
I mean, I think there are two things. One is that in many respects, the Holocaust remains the sort of watershed event of our lifetimes. It's before the lifetimes of many people today, but it remains in our historical conscience the watershed event. This is the horror of horrors. It's the event to which we compare what we see around us, whether it's in Uganda or wherever it may be. And we don't understand all of it yet. We don't understand the extent to which the Holocaust was not simply a small group of evil people carrying out an evil mission, but was something that happened because the world wasn't prepared to deal with a situation that complicated. Hmm. So that even when the Allies had the best of wills, perhaps as I mentioned earlier in the interview, they had their own motivations which prevented them acting in the very best interests of ultimately free-loving people all over the world. And I think to the extent that this book is one more reminder or one more explanation of how complicated the event was and how much we have to understand, I hope it will serve its purpose there.
Well, I really thank you for your time. It's very generous of you. I hope that we'll be able to also keep in touch over the years, because I find you're a really fascinating person.